I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Legendary chef and cookbook author Alice Waters is here today. And the wonder of liquid nitrogen in the kitchen. Salt that tastes like bacon? You bet. I'll tell you where to get it. Plus, a defender of the high-fat diet. Atkins is back. First, let's get to the Santa Monica Farmers Market to see what's in season this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're visiting today once again with David Karp, the fruit detective, and he is in town and he's just brimming with excitement over a wonderful, very rare variety of citrus fruit that he personally was able to introduce into the market system by prevailing on a farmer to grow it on the farm. So David, let's describe this very rather ordinary looking citrus, and why don't you tell us about why it's so important and how it came to be here at the market today.
Well, this is the legendary yuzu, Japanese cold hardy lemon substitute, but it's a lot more than that. Let's describe it. This is golden yellow. It's roundish but slightly flattened, about the size of a small tangerine, a bumpy rind, and that's the important part. Smell that. I'm just scratching the rind.
Oh, yeah. The essence of the oil when you scratch the rind. Oh, my gosh.
That's primarily what's used by chefs, and this is like the hottest fruit in New York restaurants now. It's the essential component in ponzu sauce. Soy sauce and yuzu, it's used in Japanese cooking.
Okay.
I went to a meal at Ginza Sushi. I was taken to it. I would never pay for that myself. Where practically everything either had yuzu or its cousin sudachi. Now, we'll explain what these are. These are echandrins. And what the heck is an echandrin? It's a cross of echang pepita, which is a primitive form of citrus that's not edible itself, with mandarin, that is tangerine. And it's grown in Japan. It's native to China. It was brought to Japan centuries ago. It's been rare here. I've seen yuzu go for $35 a pound or more retail in the United States. Budwood was smuggled in many times over the years, and it was propagated illegally here in California until recently. And 4 or 5 years ago, I wrote an article for the New York Times dining section about yuzu. Peter Shaner saw it. He talked to me about it. He planted 20 trees. And guess what? Time goes by. It's amazing.
5 years later.
Here we have the fruit. It's never been available, as far as I'm aware, at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. And here it is. It's something that is such an obvious thing because chefs go wild for it, and yet they can't get it here. Now they can.
Do we know how much Peter's going to be charging for these? Hopefully not $35.
No, I think a dollar each. But this is just his first crops. He has only a relatively few of them.
Okay. Does it have a season like the regular citrus where it hangs on the tree for months and months till it's picked?
It hangs on the tree until, January or so, where it's... in Japan, traditional to have a bath with yuzu floating in the bathtub to sort of purge yourself of the old year and perfume yourself for the new.
I bet it smells wonderful. The smell of it, it's like tart and tangy like a lemon, but it's more complex.
I think it has a little bit of grapefruit in the rind.
Yeah,
the name sounds like a Dr. Seuss.
Y-U-Z-U, yuzu. Okay, and it's very unassuming looking little fruit, so a lot of people are going to pass it right by. But thanks to you, now we've been able to spotlight it, showcase it, so stampede is on. That was David Karp, and it's so great that he comes around and he knows about these wonderful rare varieties of fruit, and then he can talk the farmers into growing them. And then 5 years later, we have it now at the market. It's just such a wonderful treat. And David, as always, we're so grateful. Thanks again.
Thanks, Laura.
We're visiting now with Marianne Carpenter, who is probably our best-known heirloom tomato grower here at the Wednesday Market. She's got a wonderful table loaded with these great winter greens.
Well, we're here today with our Tuscan kale, also called Cavallo Nero. We have mustard greens, we have green Swiss chard, we have dandelion, and we have collard greens.
Now, I know when I deal with these greens, some of them you got to take them off the stem, and then some of them you can leave the stem on, and some of them you cook the stems, especially on the kale.
Yes.
I can chew on those. It's like eating a stick.
Yes.
So,
well,
tell us which ones you need to take off the stem.
Some of the greens tend to be a little bit tough, and the stems are a little bit woody. So, especially the kales and the collards. So, we need to trim off the stem before we prepare them.
All the way down, up into the leaf, or just where it meets the leaf?
I go up a little bit,
okay.
But I don't go all the way up.
Okay.
It tends to get a little more tender towards the tip of the leaf. a good rule of thumb with the greens, the coarser the leaf, the heavier the leaf, the tougher it is, and the longer you need to cook it.
Okay.
So combine 3 or 4 different varieties because they all have a slightly different taste. And the longer they cook, the sweeter they become.
Can you cook the tough ones with the tender ones, or don't you want to cook them first?
Well, starting with the tougher ones, letting them cook, adding the softer greens a little bit later on so that, they're all ready about the same time.
So what do? Just wash them off and just throw them in wet? You don't have to do anything else?
Yes, you don't have to dry them, but just make sure they're clean. A lot of them have little crevices and nooks and crannies that catch the sand and everything, so you really have to do a thorough washing job. Sometimes I shred them or do a coarse chop before I start preparing them. And then you can, according to some recipes, you can add a little bit of bacon or a smoked like turkey wing or turkey leg or ham or some pork product to really impart some great flavor. And then you braise them in a little bit of liquid.
Covered.
Yes. They really become a sweet and great side dish.
Thanks a lot, Marianne.
Thank you.
That was Marianne Carpenter. Her farm is called Coastal Farm. They're up in Santa Paula. I want to let everybody know that we're having some fun pumpkin events at the Saturday Pico Farmers Market on the 27th of October. We're going to have a kids' pumpkin decorating, free to all kids, and you can come out to the market and you can get a little perfect little round Halloween pumpkin and you can decorate it, take it home. That'll be happening at the Pico Farmers Market from 9 till noon on Saturday the 27th. And then on Sunday the 28th at the Main Street Farmers Market, we're going to have the same thing. It'll be going on from 10 till 1. And kids can come and get a pumpkin and decorate it and take it home and have it for the Halloween. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Jonathan Gold's a Pulitzer Prize-winning critic who writes about food for the LA Weekly. We're lucky to have him join us nearly every week. He's back next with a restaurant that meets the gold standard. Stay tuned to Good Food. Once again, it's that time during the show where Jonathan Gold takes us on a little ride to one of his favorite finds. Where are we going today?
We're going to Eagle Rock.
Eagle Rock's really changing quickly these days.
It is the poster boy for gentrification in the Southland at the moment.
Unbelievable. So what is new there eating-wise?
And the latest symptom or benefit of this gentrification is a restaurant called Larkin's, which is a little restaurant in a bungalow on Colorado towards the eastern end of Eagle Rock.
And what kind of food does Larkin serve?
It's hard to say. It's like a perfect college town restaurant. It serves what would have to be called riffs on soul food.
And why are they riffs? Take a dish that's a soul food dish and tell us what he does with it.
Like, for example, the salmon croquettes, something you'll find at breakfast every soul food restaurant. He does it with fresh salmon instead of the canned salmon. He mixes it with, obviously, the breadcrumbs, but the vegetables that he mixes in are, like, really fresh and crunchy, and it has, like, a lightness to it, a spring to it, that as much as some of the salmon croquettes that will break several bones in your foot when you drop them, as much as I love those, this is almost a different creature. I mean, he does a salad with beautiful fried organic okra pods and heirloom tomatoes.
That is very gutsy, I have to say. That's gutsy. People hear the word okra and they just like are afraid. I love okra.
Well, okra's a delicious vegetable. I've got to say, when it's deep fried, then you get, ew. ew. So you have at least like three parts to one part ew. It's sort of...
The slime factor is tempered by the crust.
Exactly so. He does, as you would expect in something calling itself a soul food restaurant, he does amazing fried chicken. Pan fried, spices in the crust. Not the batter dipped, puffy, deep fryer version, but like sort of a more careful version. The meat is super juicy. He does smothered pork chops, but instead of the things that you might expect from, a place like M&M, you know, they're thick chops. It's organic pork, I think. They're really carefully cooked in the it's this really light garlicky gravy instead of the brown 40 weight stuff. Again, I love.
Of course, we know you love that stuff. So, no, you're not dissing it. You're offering this as another more upscale alternative.
Exactly. They have really good fried catfish, and I would put them in as having, if not the best, certainly among the best mac and cheese in town.
Oh, good reason to go. And what's the price point of Larkin's?
Most of the entrees are about $15 to $19. So if you're thinking of going to Larkin's instead of going to M&M, you're going to pay more and you're going to get smaller portions. It's not one of those, you know, eats till you ouches sort of place.
But, you know, you can't do that every day.
It's a wonderful restaurant with a really nice sweet potato pie at the end.
Mmm, that sounds delicious. And is there beer and wine?
I think they're aspiring to it, but at the moment you can BYOB, which is nice.
So once again, tell us where we were and where it is.
The name of the restaurant is Larkin's, and it's at 1496 Colorado Boulevard in Eagle Rock.
Thank you, Jonathan.
You're welcome.
Jonathan Gold is the Pulitzer Prize-winning critic for the LA Weekly. He's with us on Good Food nearly every week to tell us about his restaurant finds. Check out our site at kcrw.com/goodfood for info on this week's picks and other suggestions. Now, some of us, including Jonathan Gold, feel that everything tastes better with bacon. Now you can indulge your bacon cravings without having to sizzle your own strips. It's bacon salt. I'll tell you more when Good Food returns. You're a vegetarian, or you keep kosher, but occasionally you get a whiff of bacon frying and a wistful feeling wells up in your chest. Well, now you can keep your dietary moral stance and eat bacon-flavored fries. Meet Justin Esch, the co-creator of Bacon Salt. Hi, Justin.
Hi, Evan.
So where did the idea for Bacon Salt come from?
Well, Bacon Salt was an idea that really just kind of came out of nowhere. I was with my brother, and I were really the first ones who came up with the idea. We had been raised in a little town called Telluride, Colorado. There's a restaurant there called Fat Alley Barbecue that serves a drink called a Mitch Morgan. And if there was anything that inspired Bacon Salt, that was really kind of it. Mitch Morgan is a shot of bourbon with a bacon garnish. And we were discussing these kind of odd drinks that we'd had before at a wedding, a Jewish wedding in New York in October of 2006 with friends over a kosher meal. And from that, Bacon Salt was born.
Does the Bacon Salt have actual bacon in it?
There's actually no bacon in Bacon Salt. It is a truly vegetarian product. The hickory flavor is even vegan. It's based on soy proteins that are smoked and sprayed with a bacon flavoring.
And that is why it is actually certified kosher.
That's right. When we manufactured, the entire thing was certified.
So how many different variations did you try before settling on the three flavors you currently have?
The three flavors that we do have are hickory, original, and peppered. The fourth flavor was maple, and it was really just terrible. The combination of savory and sweet didn't work at all. Between those four flavors, there was about 20 different trials.
I'm so intrigued by these kind of products, these startups that begin with just an idea. Did you actually start in your kitchens with salt and soy protein? I mean, how do you go through that process?
When I started the company, it was actually Dave and I, my partner, Dave Lefko. We were actually just having dinner, talked about Bacon Salt, and decided to start it. Now, the next day, we kind of set out on this journey to start Bacon Salt. And the way that it worked is we really did try and do a mixture of, you know, like cooking bacon and mixing it with sea salts and experimenting with bacon drippings and doing all these different things. And it was really terrible, to be honest with you. Nothing tasted good. It had a shelf life of about 2 days. And we really couldn't do anything. And that's when we decided to bring in the professionals and hired a food development company to work with us on the actual recipe.
So where did you get your financing to start the company?
We're both just two guys working. We didn't have a lot of extra cash. And we decided to start the company. The following week, Dave actually was in the backyard playing with his son, a three-year-old named Dean. And Dean is actually our investor of Bacon Salt. He gave us all of our money. He actually hit Dave in the face with a baseball from a T-ball bat, which his wife captured on video and submitted to America's Funniest Home Videos, which we actually ended up winning $5,000 on, which is what we used to launch Bacon Salt.
What a funny and circuitous route.
Yeah, it worked out pretty well.
What are your favorite uses for Bacon Salt?
Personally, okay, you have to break it down by the flavor. So for original, I like it the most on green beans because it has a very savory bacon taste to it. The hickory really goes well on meats, but for myself, I like it on baked potatoes. And the peppered, which is a little bit more spicy, I really find the best use of that is in a nice Bloody Mary.
Thank you, Justin.
Thank you very much, Evan.
Justin and his partner Dave are the founders behind Bacon Salt. There's a blog all about it, plus Facebook and MySpace pages. I've got links to all of it on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. Speaking of salt, you know that you can get full flavors out of chicken and meat by letting the protein sit in salt. It's what a lot of us do in restaurant kitchens. I'll be back next with author and LA Times writer Russ Parsons with tips for salt brining. That's coming up on Good Food. We're coming up on that time of year when salt starts to loom large in everyone's mind. So we turn once again to Russ Parsons, food writer and journalist of the LA Times, for a refresher course on wet and dry brining. Hi, Russ.
Hey, Evan.
So I think people already now are worried about Thanksgiving, about fall roasting, about do we brine, do we not brine? What does brining mean? What does it do? Do I have to do it?
It's a confusing topic, and it's one that I admit that I'm still shifting on a little bit because I've always been a briner for turkey because the problem with turkey is that it dries out so badly when you roast it. Brining introduces moisture to the turkey. Essentially what a brine is, like for my turkey brine, it's nothing more than 2/3 cup salt to a gallon of water, and then you soak the turkey in that for several days. Bring it out and dry it well, and I usually give it a day in the refrigerator with uncovered because that dries the skin really well.
It gives you a really nice crusty skin.
Right. And then when you roast it, the muscle has absorbed not only the salt so that it's seasoned all the way through, but it's absorbed the water. So when you roast a turkey and then you slice it, you slice up that breast meat and you see, I mean, it's juicy. You can cook it to the point where the hip bone is completely clear. And then you've got this juicy breast. It's like heaven, right? And it also helps it brown better. So last year, I'd been hearing about this salting thing. And I had just done a story on Judy Rogers up at Zuni Cafe. And Judy Rogers is like nuts about salting things. She salts every protein that comes into the kitchen. She salts and then she sets it aside, even if it's going to be for a couple of days.
So do we.
It makes quite a difference, and especially, I think, with poultry. And so after I did the story, I started doing that. I did it so much, I started calling it Judying. Well, I'm going to Judy this. And it's not so much salt. For turkey, with the Judying method, I allow about a tablespoon of salt for every 5 pounds of weight. So, you've got a 16-pound turkey. It's like 3 tablespoons of salt. You just sprinkle it on, and then you put it in a bag, the turkey in a bag. Stick it in the refrigerator for several days. What happens then is because salt attracts moisture, so the salt pulls the moisture out of the bird, but then it makes its own little brine because it becomes wet. And then the turkey reabsorbs, or the chicken or whatever it is that you're cooking, reabsorbs the salt and the moisture. And so what it's reabsorbing is a seasoning mixture, so that you get the effect of brining, which isn't saltiness, but it's seasoning throughout the muscle. But you do it without having big pails of water.
What you're talking about sort of is a dry brining versus a wet brining.
Wet brining. And what happened was I had these two techniques that I'd been using. One of them, I'd only been dry brining chickens and things like that. So I thought, well, how would that work on a turkey? So I called Judy and she said, I've never tried it on a turkey. I don't know, but I can't think of a reason why it wouldn't. So I started experimenting with it. What I found was that it not only seasons it the way that brining does, but you know, with brining, I mean, brining is a great technique. I've been preaching it for 10 years or so, 15 years. But sometimes the meat gets
flaccid.
The texture is a little flaccid. It's a little, it's almost, it's not rubbery, but it's just short of rubbery. It's not muscle. It's not lean and hard.
It's been broken down a little bit too much.
It has. It seems like it to me. With this dry brining, that doesn't happen. With the dry brining, to me, you get the best of both worlds, where you get meat that's seasoned completely through. You get that great browning that you get with brining. But you also get a nice, really firm meat. The muscle is firm and not flabby.
So for, let's say, a 20-pound turkey, how much salt would you use?
A 20-pound turkey is 4 tablespoons or a quarter cup. And when you do that, it's a little bit of an art. You don't just like throw the salt on. You want it to be salted heavier where the meat is thicker. So, for example, at the top part of the breast on the turkey, I mean, that's a deep, deep muscle. So you want it along that area, you want it to be a little bit more heavily salted. At the hip, where the meat's very, very thick, you want that to be a little bit heavily salted. You know, at the end of the drumstick, you know, there's hardly anything there. It'll penetrate. What you need to think about is the salt has to penetrate to the bone.
And what kind of bag do you put it in?
One of the great inventions that I found in the last 5 years, 2.5-gallon Ziploc bags.
Oh, that's right. They're amazing.
They're amazing, and they're so handy. You can stick an entire turkey in a Ziploc bag. God's gift. Thank you, whoever invented that.
Now, when you do this, do you ever get fancy? Do you ever chop herbs or lemon zest into the salt?
Yes, and that's terrific. This a couple months ago, I was up in Mendocino, and I had to cook dinner for a friend's benefit. And, you know, it started out to be this little thing, ended up this huge thing, including 40 pounds of quail on a grill in a tent. You know, it was completely crazy. And so I had to prep everything myself because I didn't have any help. So what I did was I chopped up a bunch of rosemary and threw it in the salt, and then I Judy'd it. And then the next day I grilled it. And the quail was terrific. I mean, it came up nice and brown. The skin was really crisp. And there was just this very, very subtle hint of rosemary through it.
And how long do you do it? Like, let's go back to the turkey. Would you do it 2 or 3 days before, or just 24 hours?
No, with the turkey, I do 3 days, and then I do 1 day uncovered so that the skin dries out. That's really, really important.
So you uncover it, but do you wash the salt off?
No. Now, you won't see any salt. When you pull it out after a day, you'll still see the salt. After 2 days, you'll see it's almost like a little slush. 3 days, it's gone.
Wow. You have to really think ahead.
You have to think ahead for that. But you know what?
But at Thanksgiving, we're all thinking ahead. But even
with chickens, if I do it 4 or 5 hours in advance, I can tell a difference.
Well, thank you, Russ, for reminding us about this dry salting technique, dry brining. And I'm definitely going to try it this year. How to Pick a Peach is Russ Parsons' book on produce and California farming. He writes each week for the LA Times food section, too. I've got his salt brining advice on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. Alice Waters is known the world over for birthing the California cuisine movement. Her restaurant, Chez Panisse in Berkeley, started a culinary revolution. She's here in the studio next on Good Food to convince us that all good food is simple food. What can you say about a small, passionate person who's trying to change the world? Well, I say thank goodness for Alice Waters. We need someone to remind us of the ideal, the possible, the passion that we can all share in life around the table. Her latest book is The Art of Simple Food. Welcome back to Good Food, Alice.
Thank you so much.
Could you talk a little bit about the foundation of this kind of simplicity that you're talking about? Does it involve extreme attention to detail, or does it all just rest on the ingredients?
I really believe that most of cooking is about finding the really fantastic ingredients to cook with. And even the famous French chef Alain Ducasse says 85% of cooking is about finding these ingredients. And I feel the same way, that when you get a ripe tomato in the middle of summer and you slice it, you can just slice it simply, add a little salt, a little dribble of olive oil, and there you have it.
We're approaching the holiday season, and often the holiday season seems to be a time where people overburden themselves with a self-expectation of creating dishes of great complexity. I thought maybe you could give us some suggestions for really heartfelt, casual entertaining in a simple way.
Oh, well, first of all, when you make a dinner so complex, it's difficult to sit down with your friends and with your family around the table. And I think that's, of course, the most important part of it. So if you try to think of a way of putting dishes together that concentrates on maybe one thing that's hot, maybe it's a soup as the main dish. And then you can have a little salad before, and you can have cheeses afterwards, and maybe you've even made a pie or something for dessert. But it keeps you at the table because you bring that terrine of soup and pass it around, and it has a conviviality kind of built into it.
So give us an idea for a soup or two that you really love, that you think could take center stage and doesn't necessarily require that we make a complex broth to show it off to its fullest.
Well, again, when you have really tasty vegetables, you don't need that broth. And one of the amazing soups that's in this book is turnip soup. And you think, oh,
that sounds so simple.
That sounds very banal, very unappetizing. But it's one of the great flavors. And we do use the greens and puree the greens and stir them into the turnip puree. And it's really lovely. Also, all the variations on a minestrone help to sort of create the mood of that time of year. And in the winter, it has its own sort of root vegetable quality about it. And you can make a kind of, you know, a seasoning paste with parsley and garlic pounded together to stir in at the end with the Parmesan cheese. And it's a lovely kind of hearty soup.
What about a salad, a lovely, simple sort of fall or winter salad? I know that often you like to mix fruit into salad.
I do. I mean, I like those bitter chicory lettuces with walnuts and apples, of course, and with pears. Those are lovely combinations, very traditional combinations. But I also like persimmons in salads, and there are endless variations on that. But I like the little root vegetable salads as well. And thinking about lentils and farro, the different grains, and making a plate that's a combination of the colored beets of the heirloom varietals with the little pile of spicy carrot salad, maybe a little pile of lentils.
And how would we finish? What would be your dessert for this meal?
Well, I'm very fond of beautiful fruit. That is my ideal dessert, is if somebody has cut up a pear and maybe served it with a little piece of Taleggio cheese or something very, very plain like that. There are sherbets and very quick little granitas that can be made out of pomegranate juice.
That sounds like that would be fabulous for a Thanksgiving dinner.
Well, it's completely refreshing. I know that people have to have pumpkin pie. There's no question about that, and I do too. But it's nice to make little small tartlets out of it so that they're kind of bite-sized.
That's really a great idea. I love that idea of making them small. Alice, thank you so much for coming by and for producing another really beautiful book.
Thank you so much.
Alice Waters' latest book is The Art of Simple Food, Notes, Lessons, and Recipes from a Delicious Revolution. I have the recipe she mentioned today online at kcrw.com/goodfood. Foodborne pathogens are cropping up everywhere. The latest E. coli scare in ground beef points to a serious problem with controlling our food supply. But technology's not far behind. Right now, scientists are perfecting the transformation of bacteria-fighting foods into edible films that can protect us. I've got more on this fascinating research next when Good Food returns. We're getting to a point in food technology where cutting-edge science will try to meet the need to protect us from dangers in our ever-consolidating food supply. Kim Severson, staff writer for the dining section of the New York Times, recently wrote an article on edible films. So what is the melding of this particular technology for? I know that with so many problems with outbreaks caused by having this very narrow food supply where, like, all the bagged spinach comes from three places, that if there's one tiny little outbreak, just millions and millions of people are exposed. How will edible film play into that kind of a situation?
There are something like 76 million foodborne illnesses every year, according to the Centers for Disease Control, about 5,000 deaths. So one issue is people are really clamoring for a safer food supply. The other thing is they want food that's natural. These films that are made from things like eggshells or crab shells or milk sort of offer the best of both worlds. So, for example, there's something that's in our tears. It's also in the shells of crab and shrimp that naturally defeats pathogens. It's sort of the reason we don't get eye infections. So if you took the same protein and you made it into a film, this natural antibacterial will protect the food that it's on and still be a natural product.
So would the film be an inherent part of the packaging, or will it be attached to the food in some way?
Well, there are a couple of different ways that this could happen. You could take these proteins, say, and make a liquid out of it, dip a strawberry into it. It would form a natural coating that you really wouldn't notice if you ate, and then you would just consume it. You wouldn't even see it was there. There are also films that are being prepared that would be coverings for food that would release the antimicrobials as the film was on the food. So, for example, you're making, a packing plant is putting through tons of chicken breasts. You could sprinkle either in powder form or perhaps the film on the bottom of that styrofoam container. You could put a film there. The moisture from the meat would release the natural antimicrobials that would do their business and protect the bacteria from forming on the surface of the meat.
Now, you mentioned that some of these antimicrobials, they can come from shellfish or milk. What about people who have allergies? Would this impact them?
Most of these films are still in experimental stages. They're working in the labs. But there are a lot of companies and the U.S. government that are investing money and are very interested in how they work. So I would imagine that more testing would need to be done to answer that question. It is obviously a big concern.
Will we start seeing a crossover into the culinary world of the films being produced for their own sake, not for antibacterial properties?
Well, that's already happening, actually. In fact, the first real viable commercial applications are edible films that have culinary purposes. A woman named Tara McHugh, she has, for example, a film that you put over a spiral-cut ham. It's an apple film. It melts during the cooking process. It offers a little bit of moisture, a little bit of flavor. And at the same time, because it has some flavoring, some cinnamon, some clove that have the natural antimicrobials, it offers a little bit extra culinary boost as well. She's also does a carrot film that you can wrap around sushi. And there's a company, Origami Foods, that is doing just that and using the carrot film in place of nori.
Going back for a moment to this problem of foodborne illness, the one part of all this discussion that kind of bothers me is it's sort of an after the fact. They're not going to really change the way they grow things or the fact that our food supply is so centralized. They want to find a fix it that could happen sort of after the food is grown and while it's being packaged.
You know, taken to an extreme in which you're using science to fix a broken food system instead of going back to the source? I think that's the question. And certainly the researchers who are involved in this are quite aware of this. And one professor I talked to cautioned me throughout the course of our interviews. And he said, you know, this isn't intended to make up for sloppy growing and handling. Or, you know, it's not like you can have a messy processing plant and fix it by coating all the food in edible film. So I think the people who are developing this technology are quite aware of that issue. They also, I think, if I could just add, think that this might be a good alternative to irradiation, which is also thundering toward us, the idea that we would irradiate food to kill the bacteria.
How close are we to actually experiencing edible film in the marketplace?
We eat a lot of edible film now, not necessarily the kind designed specifically to be antimicrobial. And if you've eaten an ice cream cone lately, the inside of it's coated with an edible film, so the ice cream doesn't soak in. A lot of frozen foods have edible films as a layer so that moisture won't migrate from, say, the topping on a pizza into the crust. If you've eaten raisinettes, you've seen this thing called confectionery glaze, which is a coating on the food. It's actually made from a certain kind of a beetle that emits a resin, and they gather the resin and make it into this thing called shellac or edible shellac. It's probably more than you really want to think about when you're eating a raisinette. But, you know, we
chocolate and raisins
delicious.
And beetles, too.
right. It's that extra crunch. Yeah, but, you know, the wax on apples, these are all sort of examples of edible films. Now, the antimicrobials, there's actually been some interest from some food corporations to do an edible film on yogurt containers. Certainly, you've got the people concerned about their carbon footprint. And if you can create a strong enough, a good enough edible film, you can reduce packaging. So that's where a lot of the drive and the money funding some of this edible film is coming from. You know, obviously many of these companies won't tell you what they're working on, so it's hard for us to know. I think probably we'll be eating it before we are aware we are.
I always love to check in with Kim Severson. She's a writer for the New York Times and writes primarily about food. There's a link to her article on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. So are there such things as good calories and bad ones? Remember the Atkins diet? Lots of animal proteins and fats and no carbs? Well, my next guest is bringing it back. He's a correspondent for Science Magazine, and he's been getting a lot of criticism. That's next on Good Food. Everything we've been told about the benefits of a low-fat, high-carb diet were wrong? What if all the science which underpins this juggernaut of an idea was created by ignoring good science that didn't fit the theory? Gary Taubes is an award-winning science journalist who spent 5 years writing Good Calories, Bad Calories, a densely researched exploration of the low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Evan.
Let's start with an explanation of, I guess you call it in your book, Endocrinology 101, the connection between refined carbohydrates, insulin, and weight gain.
Okay. Although before I do that, I'm going to explain thermodynamics 101. For the past 50 years, we have believed that weight gain and obesity is determined by the difference between the calories you consume and the calories you expend. This is why public health authorities and nutritionists and your next-door neighbor is always telling you it's about calories in versus calories out. And there are numerous problems with this, the first of them being that it's sort of a meaningless statement. Certainly, if you get fat, you will consume more calories than you expend, but that doesn't mean that you get fat because you consume more calories than you expend. Okay? Overeating can be caused by some underlying physiological phenomenon, in which case you would overeat perhaps because you're getting fat and not vice versa. Okay, so now we get to endocrinology 101. Endocrinology is a study of hormones. And as it turns out, fat tissue, like every other tissue and organ in our body, is very carefully regulated. And what regulates it are hormones. You know, insulin, adrenaline, growth hormones, steroids, all these different hormones basically function to keep us living on a day-to-day basis regardless of what's happening in the outside world. And in the late 1950s, early 1960s, researchers discovered what it is that regulates the amount of fat we carry. And as it turns out, that is regulated almost exclusively by insulin. The hormone insulin puts calories in our fat tissue. And as it turns out, we secrete insulin in response to the carbohydrates in our diet. So if you believe in the sort of biology of living organisms as opposed to the kind of overly simplistic physics that we hear all the time, then you would think that carbohydrates make us fat. Bread, potatoes, pasta, rice, sodas, beer, sweets, all the things that our parents grew up believing really did make us fat.
But then all of a sudden there's this shift where we're being told everywhere that the cause of heart disease is excess fat and that dietary fat causes the rise in cholesterol, which causes this epidemic of heart disease.
Well, and this is what happens. In the late 50s, some very charismatic, ambitious zealots, in effect, I mean, it's a stretch to call them scientists, but a group of men came to believe that fat was the cause of heart disease. And what we have to realize, a low-fat diet, you know, fat is the cause of heart disease, and you're supposed to eat a low-fat diet. And a low-fat diet is, by definition, a high-carbohydrate diet. What you do is you replace some of the fat in the diet with more carbohydrates. So through the 60s and into the 70s, this faith in the curing powers of a low-fat diet got more and more support. It became more and more of the medical dogma. And as a result, you couldn't say that carbohydrates make you fat because you're busy saying that fat causes heart disease. And these two belief systems clashed. And the fattening carbohydrate was just kind of thrown out. Like, it was inconvenient, we can't believe it, and therefore we're going to pay no attention to it. And it's fascinating. Through the 1970s, you could just watch it vanish from the literature, as though suddenly to say that carbohydrates make you fat, which had been conventional wisdom, is to be accused of quackery.
Talk to me a little bit about what heart surgeons, people who open us up and look at our veins, think about cholesterol and the idea that dietary cholesterol is what causes heart disease.
The idea that dietary cholesterol would cause elevations in blood levels of cholesterol was kind of adopted because it made for a simpler story. You could tell people that all cholesterol is bad, and they don't have to really differentiate between what's the cholesterol in the diet and what's cholesterol in the blood. Many of the decisions that were made over the past 50 years, many of the beliefs that got integrated into this public health advice were based on trying to make complicated things seem simple enough so that any American could understand them. So we should believe, for instance, that all fat is bad and eat low-fat diets, because there was a period where people thought it was too complicated to tell people that saturated fats are the ones that raise cholesterol. And even saturated fats only raise cholesterol in comparison to other foods. So, you know, saturated fats raise cholesterol compared to monounsaturated fats or compared to carbohydrates. One of the ones I find most amazing is if you look at meat, we tend to think of, you know, meat is bad because it's got saturated fat in it. But actually, most of the fat in meat is the same monounsaturated fat that's in olive oil, oleic acid. So if you actually look at the fat components of meat, you would expect meat to improve your cholesterol profile if you ate it. But because meat contains most of the saturated fat that we eat in our diet, people just said red meat must be bad for you and we should all eat, you know, skinless chicken breasts.
So let me ask you this. Do you have your cholesterol monitored?
I had my cholesterol checked a couple years ago because my wife insisted if I was going to eat the way I eat, I should have life insurance.
And so how do you eat? Give us an example of what you eat for breakfast.
Breakfast, I tend to have bacon and eggs and sausage. I eat a pretty carnivorous diet. I eat a lot of green vegetables and a lot of meat and a lot of cheese. I eat virtually no starches. I don't eat pasta anymore, probably the one thing I miss. You know, we grew up to believe that if you eat, you know, a breakfast of eggs and bacon, it'll kill you quicker than, you know, a 9mm automatic. So, yeah, my wife had me get a life insurance policy, and they have to check your blood, and my cholesterol is fine, and my HDL cholesterol, which is probably the only thing that really matters if you look at the evidence, my HDL was very high. But again, that's only anecdotal evidence. You kind of have to read the book to know if you should believe any of this applies to you.
That was Gary Taubes. He wrote Good Calories, Bad Calories. You'll be hearing a lot about this book. We'll have a link to it on our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. It's coming close to Halloween, and candy isn't just for kids. I'll tell you about some beautiful and creepy candy that you should get your hands on. That's coming up next on Good Food. When you get to know true food artisans, you begin to anticipate new work as you would for any artist. With the first bite I took of Valerie Gordon's toffees, I already knew she was somebody to watch. And sure enough, as we approach Halloween, I received an email with a picture of one of the most striking chocolate confections I've ever seen. But let me have Valerie describe them for you. What are we looking at here?
We are looking at some very sculptural chocolates. They are entirely hand-molded. They're really about dangerous beauty.
They're skulls.
They are skulls. They come in three different colors and flavors. They are a really pristine, stark white, a really deep, scary black, and a very concentrated dark brown.
Now, the thing that interested me most about this is you see, especially during Day of the Dead season, you see skull candy and you see skeleton candy, but they're very folk art.
Yes.
Presentation.
Yes.
This goes a completely different direction.
It does.
Looks like jewelry.
Mm-hmm. And that was completely intentional. These are based on a collection by our partners in this project, DL & Company. The person behind DL & Company, Douglas Little, has a line called Memento Mori, which is about remembering. Remembering the past, making the most of the present. And he has a line of these very intricate silver skulls, and these were based on that.
Let's talk about what's inside of
okay.
these. What are the flavors?
The flavors are Curious Chili, which is a combination of four different chilies. And we also have spice in there. We have a little bit of anise and cinnamon, which I think lends a lot of mystery to the flavor. And also white pepper that sort of balances it. And I combined four different chilies because it really takes you on a little bit of a ride. You get some really high peaks of burn from Thai bird chilies. You get the nice warmth and roasted flavor of chipotle chilies, and then a nice medium sweet chili from ancho and guajillo.
Okay, I'm going to taste one.
And they're encased in a very dark, bittersweet chocolate. We used 72% cocoa, which I think holds up to these very bold, aggressive flavors that we've chosen.
Wow. Wow.
You're the second person that's laughed because it is a little funny.
It's searing yeah. heat.
Mm-hmm.
But delicious flavor at the same time.
Thank you.
Wow.
So you see, we had to use a really intense chocolate to hold up to that. So after you recover from that chili chocolate, you should try the brandy cherry, which, just to backtrack a little bit, each one of these flavors was really about taking everything to the breaking point. So that was the goal. And we want
So does that
that
mean I'll get drunk from one of these candies?
You could get a little drunk. You really could. I mean, we have packed so much brandy into these things to the point where the ganache was just about to break. And then we stop.
What does that mean, the ganache was about to break?
So ganache is a blend of cream and chocolate. When you add things to ganache, if you add too much, it falls apart. And it becomes very unpalatable
That is so delicious.
Thank you.
Now, are these only available at Halloween? Is it a seasonal product?
No, this is a year-round product. You know, skulls, sort of the perception of skulls has really changed in our society. And it's becoming very, especially in the luxury segment of the gifting population, it's something that people really covet now. And it's no longer something that you get necessarily at the drugstore and so seasonal for your kids for trick-or-treating. It's become very adult.
Now, I understand that you've even heard from a number of bridal guides.
Mm-hmm. We sent out an email 2 days ago releasing this to the public. And it was so funny because two bridal guides called us right away and said, "Oh, you're doing the most interesting things. We must talk." Which is great. It's absolutely great.
Well, Valerie, I want to thank you for coming by and showing us these beautiful edible memento moris, these incredible skulls. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
At kcrw.com/goodfood, I've got a picture of these gorgeous skulls that Valerie Confections is making. Liquid nitrogen is one of those incredible substances that cools as it melts. There's ways to use it in the kitchen, and I'll tell you about them next. That's coming up on Good Food. We're beginning to hear more and more about molecular gastronomy, and occasionally on food TV, we'll see a chef ruin his hands by plopping something into liquid nitrogen. So we got curious, what is liquid nitrogen? How does it work? And how is it used with food? Kirsten Sanford's the host of This Week in Science on KDVS, and she's with us this morning to talk about this really strange and beautiful substance. Hi, Kirsten.
Hello.
So what is liquid nitrogen?
Liquid nitrogen is the liquid form of the molecule nitrogen, the compound nitrogen. It's normally a gas here on Earth, and it makes up the majority of our atmosphere.
How cold is it?
Liquid nitrogen boils at negative 320 degrees Fahrenheit.
Okay, so this is sort of an oxymoron for some of us, that something so cold can boil.
Exactly. The reason being is that at various temperatures, things are liquid or gas or solid. And here on Earth, the temperature of nitrogen at normal environmental temperatures, it's a gas. And in order to make it into a liquid, you have to reduce the temperature significantly. And if you reduce the temperature to the point where you want to make it a liquid and then put it into room temperature, it's going to froth and boil and turn into that gas.
Now, what is it normally used for in manufacturing?
In the sciences, liquid nitrogen is used a lot to keep things cool. So if you have something, say, computer components that you need to keep cooled, you can actually place the hard drive and the components of your computer into liquid nitrogen, and they'll stay nice and cool and not overheat on a hot summer day.
Why would chefs want to play with it? Is it a texture thing?
It's a texture thing. It's also, because it's so cold, it freezes things pretty much immediately. So you can take a strawberry or a banana and put it into liquid nitrogen, and within, you know, a minute or less, you have a really frozen piece of fruit. With ice cream, because of the fact that when you put it into room temperature and you put it into contact with other liquids that are at a room temperature, which are much higher than liquid nitrogen's normal state, it's going to increase the boiling of the liquid nitrogen, so it can froth the cream and actually end up aerating the cream much more than you would get from just mixing it and doing a normal hand freezing ice cream.
One of the most interesting uses of it I saw was a chef on one of these competition shows filled a balloon with like an ice cream base and then threw the balloon into the liquid nitrogen.
Yeah.
And once it got to a place where the outer shell was frozen, he took it out, peeled the balloon off, and when people were sticking their spoons into it, the look of total sensual pleasure on their faces was, I wanted to reach in through the screen.
You're like, I want to try that too.
Is it dangerous?
Liquid nitrogen is dangerous in the fact that it is very cold, and it does boil and sometimes froth when you put things in, so you have to be aware of splatter. You definitely want to wear eye protection because of the moisture. You know, your eyes are mostly made of water, and if you were to get nitrogen into it, it would freeze. You want to also make sure you've got hand protection and that you're wearing clothing that is not close to the skin, because if you were to spill it into your clothing, you could end up with a pretty severe burn. In the sense of having it, you know, fix your food, there's no danger in that whatsoever. 78.1% of our atmosphere is nitrogen, so we're breathing it and in contact with it all the time.
Have you ever had a total disaster using liquid nitrogen for something?
Slightly. I mean, nothing where anyone was hurt, but I brought a flask of nitrogen over to a friend's house for a get-together, and I wasn't paying any attention to it. I put it in the corner until we were going to use it later, and somebody had come in and thought it was a great place to tie their dogs to. So they tied their dogs up to this flask of nitrogen, and one of the things about nitrogen storage containers is that they don't have tight-fitting tops because it'll build up pressure and it might explode the container. And something happened to startle the dogs. The dogs ran away. The leashes pulled on the container. The top flew off. The nitrogen is filling everywhere. The dogs are dragging this container around the room, and nitrogen ended up all over the floor. People were tiptoeing around this steaming patch of carpet. It was a mess. But it was so funny.
But the dogs didn't get hurt.
Nobody got hurt. It could have been a disaster.
What were you going to do with it?
Well, we did have some left. It didn't all spill out. So we did get to play with it. I was making ice cream for my friends that night and making some sorbet. It was a fun evening once the disaster was averted.
When we think about making ice cream, we think about churning. With liquid nitrogen, you don't need to churn because it freezes so quickly?
I mean, you need to blend it. So with the ice cream, you want to have a mixer, like a hand mixer, to stir it just to make sure that, I mean, because it's freezing so quickly, it ends up kind of getting into hard chunks unless you're mixing it. But because of the way that it's boiling, it aerates it much more than it would normally.
Kirsten Sanford is the host and producer of This Week in Science. I've got links to Kirsten's podcast and her website on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can find info on today's show, watch the latest videos of Good Food, and hear past episodes online at kcrw.com/goodfood. In the latest video podcast, I show you how to make delicious pasta sauce and a fantastic tomato cobbler. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Barrow. The show is produced by Thea Challoner, with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Connie Alvarez, and Holly Tarson. The music supervisor is Gary Masiha. Special thanks to Karen Soriano. I'm Evan Kleiman. Join me next week for another edition of Good Food.